The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Matt Lee.
And I'm Vince Mancini.
And this is Pod Yourself a Gun, a Sopranos podcast where me and Vince go through every single episode of The Sopranos and talk about it. I thought you were going to double up with me there, Vince.
Yeah, yeah, I like to leave you guessing what I'm going to do.
You really fucking do. First, just want to say right off the bat, please remember to give us 5 stars. I know Vince hates it when I say that, but do it. Go on the podcast app and do that. And also, just so you know, that $8 Patreon tier, pot yourself a shout out. Well, we got a few more today, so we're going to be reading those at the end of the episode. Thank you so much for doing that. And that's patreon.com/frogcast to do that. All right. All of that is done up top. Today, we have a very special episode. We're going to be talking about Season 4, Episode 3, Christopher, and our guest today from a very good podcast you may have heard of. This is our third guest from the Chapo Trap House podcast. Welcome, everybody, Will Miniker.
Hello. Greetings.
Hey, Will. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure. I'm glad you had me on for this episode. There's a lot to talk about in it.
Yeah,
and I think it's an episode that's been unfairly maligned in the Sopranos fan community. So
completely agree.
Know, for here, to me, I'm here to defend Michael Imperioli's writing and the entire episode of Christopher.
Wow, just getting in there right off the bat. That's what they say. They say they get you inject your opinion right away, and then you know you build on it. That's like we got a good start already.
Yeah. So are you a fan of The Sopranos? Is this a show you have watched?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is me. I watched all of The Sopranos when it originally aired on TV, and it was like every Sunday night appointment viewing with like my whole family. It was family watching television, and I feel like I grew up with The Sopranos and became, like, as the show came, like, as the show, like, you know, matured or like throughout the seasons, I feel like I became like AJ Soprano to my parents, like, in front of their eyes.
Your style choices started mirroring his. You started listening to new metal,
absolutely,
and shit.
You grew up in New York area, right, too?
Yeah, I grew up in New York City.
So was that, did that make The Sopranos like extra relevant in any way? Or was it just, you know, or were you just like, ah, that's New Jersey?
Yeah, I was more like, that's New Jersey. Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, it was sort of like, yeah, the exotic foreign location of across the Hudson River, you know, where I could sort of gawp at their simple and devious ways.
Yeah, so you used to watch it with your family. I tried watching The Sopranos with my family, and they just kept yelling about the violence the whole time, and eventually I had to stop watching. Is this something, what other shows did you watch with your family? Were you guys like an HBO prestige TV family, like you watched The Wire?
I mean, that was like, The Sopranos was like our sort of entryway, like most of America, into the world of prestige TV. I think The Sopranos is the one like HBO show that I don't really remember. I think I watched The Wire with my mom, actually, but I don't know if my dad ever got into it. But yeah, I mean, hilariously, the other shows I can remember that were like appointment TV, that was like, they were not like, they were like hour long dramas, was hilariously enough, The West Wing and Ally McBeal.
Holy
those
shit.
Those are my family TV watching. Those,
people sleep on Ally McBeal television these days.
Yeah, no, Ally McBeal was a groundbreaking show, man. It was like a surrealist comedy it had the first memes were on there. They had the dancing baby all up on there.
Oh, God, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Mambo number 5.
Yeah, straight up. I mean, that was a groundbreaking show for posters, if you think about it. Thank God for them.
Well, now she's married to Harrison Ford, right?
Is that right?
I think so.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah.
Ugh. Gross.
which way is that gross? For who? Which one is that gross for?
I think it's gross for both of them because she's she's very meek and mild, and he seems like, I don't know, he's got an earring, you know, like he's got a pierced ear. I just don't want to, everything about that just grosses me out. But hey, you know, good for them. I'm glad they're fucking.
Sure. Yeah, glad they found love.
That's pretty sick. All right, let's get into today's episode. But before we start this podcast, we first must listen to the theme song. Pod. Yourself again. Your mom always said you'd be the chosen pod. Pod. Podcast. Blue moon in your eyes. Pod. 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 Podcast.
All right. Yeah. Shout out to the Alabama 3 featuring Matt Lieb once again.
One day we're going to get sued. At some point, all podcasts, I think, are going to start to get like DMCA claims or whatever the fuck those are.
No way,
are.
Man. Fair use. That's fair use.
Is that fair use? Because I added
I'm
pod
gonna say
to
it,
it?
Is. Yeah. I think so.
All right. Fair enough. Yeah, please don't sue us, Alabama 3. They're Maoists. They don't believe in suing. Today, we are talking about. From season 4, episode 3 of The Sopranos, Christopher, which premiered on September 29th, 2002. Vince, why don't you break us off a little piece of that synopsis?
Columbus Day ignites tensions between Italians and Native Americans, and Bobby receives devastating news about his wife.
That's right. It is. It's a very interesting episode. Before we get into it, I mean, what was happening at the time that this episode came out? I mean, we have to know.
You got
to
know the context for your art, the cultural context. And we do that by taking a little trip in the Remember When machine. Walk, walk, teddy, daddy, bop, bop, shoo, bop.
Remember then. Remember when is the lowest form of conversation.
That's right. We're going back all the way to September 29th, 2002. This is an episode in which Rudy Giuliani is used as the great contrast for, you know, negative portrayals of Italian Americans. Like, you could either be a mobster or you could be a great American.
Like Rudy Giuliani.
And it just so happened that in September 29th, 2002, Rudy Giuliani was in the midst of a book tour for his book, Leadership, about his time leading the city of New York during the September 11th attacks. And somehow he found time to complete and publish a book in that 1 year time period.
What is it with Italian American political leaders that makes them feel like immediately publishing a book about their exploits before their fall from grace?
Oh, you mean there's someone else doing this?
Well, yeah, that's Andrew Cuomo released a book about how he you know, defeated the pandemic. And then turned out that a lot of people in nursing homes died, and then also he fondled a bunch of his staffers or some shit. But it's very strange.
To be fair to Rudy Giuliani, I mean, when he published that book and was doing the book tour for it, like 9/11 was technically over.
That's right.
That's true.
So Cuomo really got ahead of his skis on this one.
Yeah.
It was like, this fucking pandemic wasn't even close to being done when he fucking put that book out there.
Yeah, that's very true. He did do it right in the middle of it. Whereas like 9/11 kind of just happened in a day and we're like, that's done. We're done with that. But I mean, you know, like, it is amazing to see the amount of, like, just the amount of foreshadowing. If ever an Italian-American politician ever writes another book, I'm going, give it 6 months. This guy's going to fall fucking apart.
The reference to Giuliani in this episode is great, and I know it was done like self-awarely, like as a joke, like mm-hmm. you know, when the luncheon lady says, you know, like when they say John Gotti, you say Rudolph Giuliani, and everyone, like all the biddies at the church luncheon are like applauding and they love it. I mean, that was obviously done as a joke, but like what's so funny to think about now is like if you were writing that TV show now, like that character saying Rudy Giuliani, like the joke wouldn't work because that character I don't think even could grasp, like could reach that low. Like Rudy Giuliani is so tarnished by now that mm-hmm. like he would have to say Andrew Cuomo, which would be right. funny still. Yeah.
he spent like 6 months just doing a Nordberg from Naked Gun, where like one day his hair was dripping and like during a press conference, the next day he's bringing like the crazy revenge porn stripper lady and then the press conference where the first speaker was
the Four Seasons landscaping.
Yeah, where the first speaker was a convicted child molester. It's incredible.
Farting on.
Oh yeah. My God!
No, during testimony, during actual testimony under oath, he just farts.
I mean, that's just a testament to how good a month he was having that I left farting on a hot mic out of the month that he had. So I got two headlines here. This one's from the New York Times, first from September 29th. Giuliani says city was prepared on 9/11.
Really? Was it?
Yeah, everyone. Cool. A certain segment of people got phone calls right before it happened, so they were very prepared.
You know, the funny thing with that is, like, Giuliani's reputation as being America's mayor is largely based on the news footage of him wandering around Lower Manhattan covered in dust, like, looking up bewilderedly and just, like, coordinating with his, like, city planners and whatnot. But they were only doing that because Giuliani, during his tenure as mayor, moved New York City's Emergency Response Command Center into the World Trade Center.
That's a fact. Damn, so like bonehead
move. They were wandering around the streets because they literally had nowhere to go to coordinate New York City's emergency response to a disaster like this, because he chose to put the command center in the World Trade Center complex. And this is, of course, after the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993.
That's a great segue for this article. Rudolph W. Giuliani, in his first detailed account of his administration's actions on 9/11, said mistakes were made at the World Trade Center, but the city was as well prepared as could reasonably be expected. He also said he believed that some firefighters, aware of the peril, died after choosing to stay in the doomed building to save others.
I mean, a lot of them died because they were sent into the building in the first place, which was a complete disaster. I mean, that was a total error in judgment. I mean, I'm not gonna gainsay, you know, looking back, Monday morning quarterback this whole thing. But, you know, that is the big issue about why most of the firefighters who died on 9/11 died, is because they were sent into a building as it was coming down.
Right. So this came during his book tour, which means that there was other Giuliani articles and other publications. So I just wanted to contrast this with the article in the Post about Rudy Giuliani's book tour. Headline, I'd Fry Bin Laden. Rudy Bears Slay Wish in New Book.
Slay Wish?
If Osama bin Laden is ever apprehended, Rudy Giuliani wants to be the one who ends the terrorist's life. The former mayor says he made that startling request directly to President Bush just before the commander-in-chief's first emotion-filled viewing of Ground Zero, 3 days after the September 11th terror attacks. If you catch this guy, Bin Laden...
Very brave of him to share that tidbit, you know, circa 2002, you know, just being like, hey, just so everyone knows, I would like nothing more than to execute Osama bin Laden. What? Can he say that? Rudy, calm down.
Just a brave stand.
What a badass.
Yeah, he's a tough guy. You can tell just by looking at him. If you catch this guy, bin Laden, I would be the one to execute him, Giuliani recalls saying. I was serious.
Oh, good.
Okay. Good. I wasn't just bullshitting. Okay, that's good.
Yeah. Throughout the 396-page book, due out Tuesday, the city's 107th mayor weaves stories culled from his career as a federal prosecutor, his childhood, and his 8-year reign at City Hall that ended 3 months after the most horrific attack on U.S. soil. From his childhood, Giuliani tells of instigating a fight with a neighborhood bully at age 5 to win favor from an uncle.
I wonder Trump likes him so much.
He won plaudits.
He has exactly the same brain.
Yeah, no, he was tough when he was 5. He won plaudits from his boxing-minded father and a scolding from his order-minded mother. So, you know, that's just a slice of Giuliana Canna. I don't know how you say that.
It's Giuliana Canna.
Yeah,
that's
there
right.
We go. So the movies, top movies in the country, September 29th, 2002. We had Sweet Home Alabama. The movie that gave us Josh Lucas, unfortunately.
Oh, no. Was that the first Josh Lucas?
I think that's the one where I think that was what popularized Josh Lucas. I have like a weird reaction to Josh Lucas's voice.
Well, he's only in Christian movies. he always plays a Christian guy who's just trying to, you know, make women better at being women and shit like that.
Yeah, no, he'll play like a good Christian guy or a complete prick. Like those are his two.
Yeah, that's true.
He's like other. He's like a real asshole. Like a yeah. Real, yeah. Real jerk.
Sweet Home Alabama gave us the baby face Josh Lucas, and that's probably the reason he does Home Depot ads today. this number two movie was The Tuxedo, you know, latter day Jackie Chan, I think. And then Barbershop.
Hell yeah.
Songs, the Billboard Top 100, that was Fallen by Alicia Keys.
Right, Fallen. That's her ode to New York and the buildings falling down. Right?
Is that true? I don't even remember it. It should be right. I don't know.
It's not right.
and then the rock's top rock song was Aerials by my Armenian brothers, System of a Down.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, that's nice. A song about the planes flying into the building. All right.
you know, people forget what it was like in America in 2002, and like basically everything was just still about 9/11.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could not escape 9/11 unless you were watching Sex and the City. You could not escape it. Like, even The Sopranos covered it. Sex and the City seems to be the one thing that just decided to ignore that 9/11 ever even happened. It just continued on, even though it would have made for a lot of great storylines. They just decided it was too sad. So, yeah.
Maybe they're going to tackle that in the next reunion.
In the next movie?
Like, yeah, the next Sex and the City reboot that comes. They're finally going to break their legendary silence on 9/11.
I hope so, dude, because, you know, either that or just do a Jeffrey Epstein episode. I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. All right. So those are the Wayback Machines. That's not what we say.
That was the Wayback Machine. Matt, yeah. What did we have for... take us through this episode. What are some of the Bada B stories?
Sure. Just real quick, here's what happens in this episode in the form of 1492 couplets that I wrote real quick right before we got on the Zoom. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. In 2002, the Sopranos explored a culture war issue. A protest of Columbus by the First Nations has Silvio crying discrimination. Polly tells Johnny a joke that is cruel, while Janice pegs Ralphie straight up Vafangul. Karen crashes a car and dies. We never really met her, yet everyone cries. AJ is reading Howard Zinn. Hesh gets into a fight with Ruben. A trial is held for Junior's case, and this episode explores identity politics used in bad faith. All right, those are the Bada B stories. I like to rhyme them. It's fun.
So is this like the most infamous sort of what would you call this? Like a one-off episode, like a digression episode, standalone?
It's a standalone for sure. I mean, you really don't get much.
Should we call this like a very? Was this a very special episode of The Sopranos?
I think that the alternative title is this is a very special episode of The Sopranos. This is our after-school special in a kind of like fucking bizarro world where after school specials just tell you that identity politics are bad and racism is okay if everyone is being racist to everyone at the same time. I didn't know that this was like a much like maligned episode of The Sopranos. I had no idea until very recently. I was reading about it and people said like they hated this one, which I do not understand at all.
I think maybe it's because like they felt it like the it was a little too broad, like the humor or sort of like the it was just a little it was a little bit wacky. I think, and like I don't think people were really like feeling that, but. I mean, like I've always thought this is a good episode. I mean, like, because I think it's a very funny episode, and there's a lot of like really memorable, funny lines and moments in it. But like, more than that, like this episode really does set up like a lot of things that are very important later in the show. I mean, it forecasts, you know, I mean, the death of Bobby's wife, and also like the beginning of like the feud between Johnny Sack and New Jersey,
right?
And
this
is the first episode with Pyomai in it.
That's
Pyomai
right.
Pyomai is introduced for the first time in this episode, and you know, like it just so like there's a lot of stuff going on here. And if anything, I think maybe people didn't like it because this is really not a Tony episode at all.
Right.
Tony is in this episode very little. Like he really fades to the background. He's only in it for like a little bit, and then he gets that sort of monologue at the end where he's like, he puts all the identity politics people on blast. He owns he owns it's anti Italian American gets owned for believing in Columbus Day.
I mean, I think in the context of the show, like you can look back and you can point to all the things that it set up, but I think definitely if you're watching the show in sequence and at the time it came out, you definitely get to the end of this episode and you kind of think, well, that was weird. Because you're not, I mean, at this point in the show, you're not really used to like one-off torn from the headlines episodes of The Sopranos. And then this one comes in there and it's, you know, it does have a lot of continuity with, you know, later parts of the show and certain parts of, you know, previous episodes. But it does feel like the most like a departure from other things.
I don't know.
It's funny though, because it's the funny thing about it is like it's not really torn from the headlines. Like as an issue, like people protesting Columbus Day, like that seemed to be like way more of a '90s thing. I feel like they were reaching back to make it seem like this was like for the people viewing it as it aired, that this would be like have some sort of like real strong resonance. And I think like it mostly just kind of came across as a joke at the expense of everyone on, you know, on every side of this issue.
Right. Well, that's the funny thing is that it became more relevant because like a month after this episode aired, the two, Lorraine Bracco and Dominic Chianese were supposed to march in the Columbus Day parade, and the organizers sued to keep them from marching because they thought like The Sopranos was like a bad
What?
Yes.
They thought that they were doing anti-Italian discrimination. Yes.
Well, they thought, was that organization run by Dr. Melfi's husband? this is life imitating art, imitating life again. I don't know. Yeah, it's just
I mean,
it's funny watching it now. It does seem very much ahead of its time in this, like, because it has this very scabrous, jaundiced vision of like how everyone outside of sort of like the dominant like Anglo-American culture is just sort of like just policing the territory of their oppressions that happened to like the ancestors like centuries ago. And it's like, yeah, it's this very like kind of very cynical look at identity politics, like, you know, as voiced by like some of the worst, most racist criminal scumbags imaginable.
Right.
I mean, yeah, the episode basically says that like ethnic identity is a grift. Like that's kind of the driving sentiment behind this whole thing.
Yeah, it's hard to tell whether like this show is, or this episode specifically is, it's either remarkably prescient or we've been fighting the same culture war battles for the last 50 fucking years and they just keep getting recycled over and over again. Because like, you know, the Columbus Day thing, I'm sure at the time they were like, oh yeah, we had that discourse in the 90s, but that discourse is now every year on Twitter. I mean, like, this is very much a Twitter discourse episode of The Sopranos,
really,
where you're just having the same fucking conversation over and over again. Everyone's got an opinion about it, and all of the opinions are they're just all hackneyed. They're just like, you're just tired of it. And I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of people didn't like it, because they were like, The Sopranos usually does this kind of like almost like a scattershot approach. They'll add a little bit of their like weird Italian identity shit in other episodes and not dedicate an entire episode to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you see it from so many different perspectives and angles in this episode. Like everybody is getting in one way or another on like the the theme of the episode. And you're right, like, that is very much against type for like what the usual approach to the show, which is just, yeah, it's just like a little bit of everything is seeded over the course of the entire arc of
right.
the series. And like this episode just really is just about kind of about one thing. But which sort of like it makes it easy to sort of like you know, pick out or sort of
right.
point at or like or not like.
Yeah, but I do think that like this is an episode that like if you aren't completely obsessed with holding The Sopranos to a ridiculously high standard, like you're gonna like this episode. It's yeah. fucking. It's one of the funniest episodes.
Oh, it's so funny.
It
has so many classic Sopranos moments in it yeah. too. I mean, like I love like it's got the classic opening of just all the boys hanging out in front of the pork store, just chilling out.
Yes.
And, like actually, in that scene. Furio actually has like the funniest like puncturing of this stupid bubble of like, you know, ethnic pride and
oh, it's so great.
So like immigrant groups in America and the way they see themselves and the way they like compete with one another over who's more discriminated against.
Mm-hmm.
Where he just goes through this whole thing where he like to their shock and surprise, he lets them know that actual Italians
right.
Italian Italians don't even like Christopher Columbus because actual Italians don't even think of themselves as fucking Italian.
Right.
They think of themselves as from Naples or from mm-hmm. Genoa. And he says, I don't like so much the North. They have the money. They think they treat us like peasants for many centuries. And then, of course, they're all like, oh, what are you?
I got that clip.
You know what it is? It's anti-Italian discrimination. Columbus Day is a day of Italian pride. It's our holiday. And they want to take it away.
Fuck them. But I never liked Columbus. In Napoli, a lot of people are not so happy for Columbus. Because he was from Genova.
What's the problem with Genova?
The north of Italy always have the money and the power. They punish the south since hundreds of years. Even today, they put up their nose at us like we're peasants. I hate the north.
Take it easy.
I love it so much because like I love that to Furio, the true victims of Columbus were the southern Italians.
Exactly.
Those are the people he victimized the most.
I mean
the genocide was bad, but he turned their nose up at us.
It punctures like, the whole thing because it's like they have this fucking debate every year about like what Columbus means to like Italian identity, and it's like when he sailed, Italy wasn't a country. There was no Italian identity. Like they,
and it was the Spanish who sent him over there.
Yeah right.
The Italians kicked him out of his own fucking country. They wanted nothing to do with him because he was like a con man and had blown off like all their investments.
The thing that drives me nuts every time they talk about Columbus, and I know this is like getting drawn into like a discourse that the show is like openly making fun of, but they always mm-hmm. do this thing where he's just like, oh, well, you know, in the context of his time, like he was fine. Like, you know, he was a great man in the context of his time. It's like they threw him in jail for being a dickhead during his lifetime. Like if you get the people who did the Spanish Inquisition threw him in jail because he was such a prick. And everybody acts like, oh no, you know, this is just our modern sensibilities, like saying that he's bad.
Yeah. It is like, and didn't you say, Amerigo Vespucci?
Vespucci is named after a different Italian guy.
Right. Just like I don't understand not celebrating him, but
he's our guy. He's the one thing we got. I mean, well, yeah, other than the actual name of America, but yes. Like.
Oh, man. But going back to that opening, man, that opening is fucking so fucking funny just because they're all hanging out in front of the pork store doing literally nothing.
Yeah, could not be contributing less to American society. In fact, if anything, they're badly taking away from
and
they're gambling on people's license plates and shit. just tanning themselves, just being fucking just louts on a street corner, and they're fucking so angry about their pride being wounded.
Oh, it's so great. We have a clip of that.
My favorite move, by the way, is that there's a guy who's like morbidly obese. You know, he's like some 350-pound dude. But still so vain that he's like tanning himself with the reflector in the sun.
Yeah, he wouldn't want to be pale.
Yeah.
That would suck.
Yeah, you know, that when you get tan, it's very slimming.
But I have an opening, a clip of the opening.
Mm.
It's called opening scene.
Oh, yeah. Well, now you tell me.
Oh, Massachusetts!
Listen to this shit.
The New Jersey Council of Indian Affairs has announced plans to disrupt Monday's Columbus Day parade in Newark. To launch their protest, the Native Americans and their sympathizers plan to begin a death watch tomorrow over the Statue of Columbus in Christopher Columbus Park.
Some fucking balls bad-mouthing America, especially now.
Uh-oh. You know what that sound means. That sound means it's time for our new segment, Who Did 9/11? That's every time they mention 9/11 in The Sopranos from here on out, we have to ask our guest, Will, who did 9/11?
Oh, wow. This is a bit of a hot potato, but I will say in terms of the people who, you know, did 9/11, I think it is, you know, pretty much as the 9/11 Commission would have you believe. I think it was a group of Saudis and Egyptians funded with Saudi money who flew those planes into the World Trade Center. But everything outside of that, much different question in terms of why did the single greatest breach in American national security history happen when like the FBI and CIA and like all those guys had all of these dudes like under surveillance and like had like numerous fucking memos and fucking like, you know, intelligence stating exactly what was going to happen in fall of 2001. That is a whole different but if you're talking literally who did it, I would just
so
say
what I'm,
the guys you think did it.
What I'm hearing is Bush did 9/11.
Yes, he did.
Okay. All right, moving
on. Let's put it this way. I have no problem with anyone saying Bush did 9/11 as a joke or as a sincere statement of political belief or the evidence, historical record. I have no problem with it one way or the other.
I'm saying the Illuminati for the record.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's the same shit. Same shit. All right, back to the story. So Syl is none too pleased that their heritage, a.k.a. Columbus, is being attacked.
So you have some background on how this came to be, right? On why Syl was not traditionally like the character in the show who took offense at slanders of Italians.
Right. So and for me, when I've seen this episode like a couple of times, and it never really read as off to me until again I started doing reading about this episode. And this is a very Syl-centric episode. Well, what I found out was that it was supposed to be Pauly. Pauly was going to be the character who was, you know, because he's always the one who's always talking about his Italian.
Make more sense given the characterization, because usually like, and Syl is usually never a guy who really like instigates the action of an episode either.
Yeah,
he's always a guy who's sort of reacting to things or sort of in the background, but very rarely is a character who's sort of the engine of a plot of a given episode.
Right. He's like his role is never to kind of be autonomous. His role is always to, you know, he gives counsel to Tony and he has his own opinions, but he's never taken like center stage before like this. And it's in a way that, you know, looking back, it would have made more sense with Pauly.
Yeah. I mean, he's literally supposed to be the consigliere. So he's supposed to be the, you know, the level headed advisor.
Right,
guy.
Right.
But I kind of think this is like a happy accident.
Me too.
I like that we've added this wrinkle of Syl that he is also kind of a thin-skinned prick, and you know, and I like that he. It almost seems like they gave him irony poisoning in this, because I think the whole point of the taking offense to the Columbus thing, it's supposed to be like a misdirect, like a deflection. Like traditionally, it's, you know, them using it as a way to sort of distract from, you know, like whatever illegal thing that they're doing.
Sure, but yeah.
It kind of feels like Syl kind of got caught up believing their own bullshit, where he's actually mad now.
He pays money to the Italian Anti-Defamation League, which is just...
It also brings up the fact, the actual history that he said, like, you know, as friends of ours who set this all up, it was Joe Colombo. It was like the New York City mob guys.
Right.
Who were in, I think, like the 70s or early 80s. And this is portrayed in The Irishman, too. the whole anti-Italian American discrimination league, because they were like, oh, we're being stereotyped as organized criminals just because we are organized criminals who murder and intimidate people for a living.
Honestly, it's groundbreaking bad faith identity politics. It really is. It's like they invented the telephone and they invented bad faith identity politics.
I mean, it's funny. I mean, like in The Irishman, it's basically set up that, like, you know, crazy Joey Gallo or whatever gets clipped because he disrespects the entire idea of, like, you know, he points at the button on Pesci's like lapel and he's like, you believe in this bullshit?
Right.
I mean, that's a classic American story, though, is coming up with a fake story, and then the people closest to you end up forgetting that it was a fake story to begin with and just taking it taking it as whole cloth.
It definitely makes more sense it being a Polly episode rather than a Syl episode, but I do think it was a happy accident. I like that it gives Syl a little bit more depth and whatnot. And also, Polly, the actor, apparently injured his back, and so he couldn't film, so they just like wrote him as someone who's in jail. And I like that they used what they could from him, and they made him be the snitch,
right,
who tells Johnny Sack the joke.
I think it's funny, like, in terms of this episode being groundbreaking, like, I think Polly was like snitch tagging pre-Twitter in this episode.
Yeah, he totally was at Johnny Sack. I hope you weren't too offended by this joke at Ralphie Cifaretto.
Well, yeah. as long as you brought up Ralphie, there's another very important part of this episode that I think we need to discuss.
Yes.
Which is, it features yet another of the basically history's most horrific sex scenes ever depicted in any medium,
yes,
starring Janice Soprano. I don't think this one quite rises to the level of her dalliance with Richie Aprile when during their sexual role play he holds a gun to her head.
Uh-huh.
But this one is really something as well. I mean, because it makes explicit Ralphie's sort of like his he tops from the bottom and this whole sort of like pegging thing. And I watched this episode again. I watched this episode with my parents. So when she's like fucking him with a vibrator and just saying, and he's like, "Put me back on the street, baby," and she's like, "Your mama's little tramp, mama's little hua." The end of her and Ralphie's relationship in this episode is extremely funny.
So
their arc is perfect.
So I had a question about, you know, the detail. So, you know, she's pegging him in the beginning of that scene, and you hear the vibrator sound, and then he gets a call from Ro.
And the Rocky theme plays while he's getting fucked in the ass.
That's such a good detail.
It's a perfect detail. It's so funny.
Okay, so what I'm interested in is he gets a phone call from Ro, and Janice turns over under the covers, and the vibrator is still going on.
Oh.
And as like my wife pointed out, my interpretation initially was just that she hadn't figured out how to like turn it off yet, and she pointed out like, oh no, Janice is pleasuring herself with the dildo or with the vibrator pulled out of
shit.
Ralphie's ass.
No, I
would just assume it was still up his ass.
Yeah, I would assume that. I thought that's where we were going with this.
This is really funny. Actually, I never noticed this part before watching it, before today's episode. But like, okay, so Ro calls him on the phone and he's like, yeah, I'll take care of that. Like, okay, like I'm coming over now.
Yeah.
And then like as he gets on the phone, Janice says to Ralphie of their relationship, she says, "We're so wacky.
We're so wacky.
We're so wacky." And like, that fucking killed me. Oh my god.
It's such a sociopathic like so perspective. Wacky. We're so wacky. Wacky is not at all what's happening here. It's like
it's terrible.
It's awful. Yeah, I mean, it's like fuck the moral implications of like cheating. It's like, not only are you cheating, but you're continually fucking him in the ass with the vibrator as he's on the phone with his girlfriend. Wacky is the perfect way to describe it.
I feel so wacky, and Ralphie's so sprung for it. Like, that, I mean, later in the episode, there's gonna be, I think, like an even I mean, not even funny, like a really terrible scene where he just dumps Ro.
Yes.
Like he just really because he's like, he's like, we can be free. We can be in the open. We can just, it's only sex from that on. It's like, oh, it's just, Ralphie is such a creep. It is just, yeah. He's
well, and
really a singular character.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
He's
show.
Completely mm-hmm. misinterpreted what yeah. Janice likes about him to begin with, because he's yeah. like, oh, yeah, exactly, now we can just be a regular couple. Like, yeah.
Now we can have no emotional connection whatsoever, and you just fuck me in the ass and pretend you're my pimp. And like, she's in therapy, like complaining about this very thing, because yeah, what she likes about him is that she likes that they're so wacky. She yeah. likes their wackiness. She likes the sociopathic nature of mobsters in general, and like, you know, breaking up with a girl yeah. to get right with the mistress is like, that's too good for her, you know.
And I love the scene of Janice and her therapist, where she's like, she's talking about this, you know, I'm not giving devils, you know, the full details, I would imagine, but she just goes like, you know, I this goes back to my family and my mother and father, and I had no love and support, and I was shamed for being artistic.
Yeah.
I like that the therapist in that scene is doing the same thing that the Dateline NBC guy does whenever he seems like, where he seems like he's kind of getting off on people talking mm-hmm. about murder.
Yes.
Like, Janice is like, oh, this all goes back to my mother and my father, and the therapist is like, yes, go on.
I have a clip of that.
The last time that you dated a friend and colleague of your brother's, he left you flat, disappeared into the witness protection program,
which brings me back to my childhood and my mother. And my father.
Now we're talking.
Where I had no love.
Now we're talking.
And no support. And where I was shamed and ridiculed for being artistic.
The hell mm-hmm. with them.
I know.
The work is to make new choices that have nothing to do with old patterns.
I want it, Sandy. I do. God give me the strength.
She will.
Oh, she will. Sorry,
she yeah. will. Yeah, it's she just... will.
I also think that the vibrator phone call scene, it kind of feels like it was a bit of a riff on like the Bill Clinton cigar story that would have been kind of fresh at the time.
You think so?
Yeah. Oh, wait. No, he wasn't. No, he was getting a blowjob when he was getting the phone call, because he couldn't have been on the phone while he was using the cigar. That'd be weird.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm still going with my theory.
He's possible. It's possible he could have done that. But no, I mean, I saw it more as just like they just tried to up the ante on, you know, her previous relationship with fucking Richie Aprile. So they were like, let's have her, you know, fucking Ralph in the ass. And then, you know, and then the theme to Rocky plays on the phone.
Right.
Also, I mean, like the whole thing with her and Ralphie, like, I mean, it sets up her relationship with Bobby. Like, also in this episode, there's like the contrast between Bobby's relationship with his wife and everyone else is also really like brought into stark relief in this episode, because, you know, the death of Karen, who's like, you know, mm-hmm. not really much of a character. But then when she dies, it's like Bobby really becomes more and more of a character. And like in this episode, when you see just poor Bobby, like just how absolutely bereft he is by the death of his wife, and just like how crushed he is by it. And like there's this scene at the funeral where it's like Carmella and the rest of the wives, like, you mm-hmm. know, like seeing this man like weep weep for the loss of his true love. Mm-hmm. And like they all are just seeing like what it looks like to have a man who like actually loves his wife.
Right.
And it's yeah. it's really it's brutal. I mean, like this whole thing, it's a really brutal part of the show, but like they talk about how like she, you know, Syl's wife says that like, you know, I overheard him on the phone one time and they were all making fun of him because he was the only one who didn't have a guma.
Right, right.
Like they all get this glimpse of like what it's like for like to be a man in this world who like it goes against type, and by going against type, it's like a guy who genuinely has like emotion and feelings for a woman at all.
Right,
right.
I also feel like it's funny. Like I think like Bobby and Georgie are always competing to be. I forget the Kilgore Trout character from Vonnegut where he invents this character whose entire purpose is just to be like tortured by the author. But like Bobby and Georgie are always. They're always. It seems like they go out of their way to write like mean shit that happens to them.
Wait, and who's Georgie?
Georgie is the guy who manages the Bing. Who like whenever Tony comes in and beats him up. And then in this episode, like when they go to when they try to start a fight with the Native Americans in front of the Columbus effigy, like mm-hmm. the first person who gets beat up is Georgie.
That's
of course.
Great.
Oh man, that scene is so funny too, because like it's classic Artie Bucco moment in that scene where like they all pile like 18 old Italian men pile out of the same station wagon like it's mm-hmm. a fucking clown car. And they show up to like the Newark Columbus statue to like, you know, start some shit with the protesters. Yeah. And as soon as it pops off and like the cops get involved and bottles start getting thrown, Artie just immediately runs to the car, but not before getting hit with like a slushie.
He gets hit with a slushie.
So he's just like, he's cowering in the car, like covered in like a drink or something. And it's just perfect Artie moment. Artie never wins on the show. Yeah. Artie is perennially the most cucked man in existence.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Well, there's
got a lot of. Oh, go ahead.
There's another really good sight gag in that sequence where the oldest guy, like they, you know, they pile out of this car to go intimidate the protesters, and one guy is like so old that someone else has to help him out of the car, and of course, like that guy is the first one who starts yelling at the protesters. He's like the first one to start talking shit.
Yeah.
Another
yeah.
little gem in that scene is it features a cameo as one of the Newark cops by a racist Italian comedian, Nick DiPaolo.
I missed that.
One of the cops where he's like, Syl, they got a permit. And you know, like, yeah. So that was Nick DiPaolo, who would not be out of place in any other part of this episode as well.
He watched it like totally seriously, like just going, yeah, I also hate identity politics. These fucking blacks always complaining. The Moulinat, but yeah, no, that scene, it's great because like there's a moment where you just barely catch it, but at some point when Artie gets the slushy thrown at him, you just hear someone in the background scream, "Down with globalization!" And there's something about that that's just like close to my heart, because I just remember the, I don't know, I would call it like the pre 9/11 left, which, you know, where anti-globalization was like a big thing, so it was always shoehorned into things like including this protest against Columbus. I loved that.
So, yeah, and then, like, the another overarching storyline in this episode is, like, the competing ethnic grievances, which leads into the big scene between Hesh and his, like, Cuban horse trainer.
who we've never seen before. And I have to admit, there's part of me that goes, like, I love that the stakes on this relationship don't matter. It's literally just played for the jokes. You know what I mean? Because they have this fight, and this fight would matter a lot more if you knew who the fuck Ruben was and, you know, what their friendship meant. But instead, they're like, no. This is just for the jokes.
It's just a gag.
Yeah.
And he's the guy who we know well from stealing the armoire from Kramer in Seinfeld.
And he also is the guy who said, "Who does not want to wear the ribbon?" Isn't he the one?
I think so. Yeah, that's right.
But we have a clip of the scene between Hesh and Ruben.
It's Columbus Day protest. We need somebody to make her go away.
What's wrong with freedom of speech?
Yeah? She damn my kid's talking about Columbus. She calls him a thief and a murderer.
Well, they wiped out almost all of my people.
Cubans are from Spain.
Strictly speaking, they were Taino Indians who got raped by Columbus and the conquistadors.
That's right, Reuben.
Muoñan got Martin Luther King Day. What do we got?
I can't say I don't have any sympathy for the red man.
Why is that?
Jews, because of their history, have common cause with the oppressed.
That's right. Christopher Columbus was no better than Adolf Hitler.
Hey, whoa. Back up.
Hitler? Yeah. I'm not the only one who thinks so.
You're talking out of your ass. Columbus and Hitler? You're trivializing the Holocaust. Frankly, Reuben, if you got that kind of covert anti-Semitism, I'd like you to leave my house.
Anti-Semitism?
That's right.
Fuck you too, my man! Oh.
Well, it's great because he starts, but well, you know, Hesh points out that, you know, Jews commonly take the side of the oppressed. And then Reuben pipes up that he hates Columbus because he identifies with the Taino Indians, which is another fun wrinkle in that scene.
And then also, like, his fucking, the whole guise of, like the idea that, like, oh, we have common cause as Jews with the oppressed. And then someone's, like, tries to compare their oppression, and he goes full ADL, and he's just like, nothing compares to the Holocaust. Which is, like, there are situations in which it's, like, obviously a bad comparison. But I'm pretty sure that the genocide of Native Americans is up there with the Holocaust. Like, the
it's
idea
in the
that...
conversation.
It's in the conversation.
It's wildly out of left field. Yeah.
It's an insane thing to get offended about, and they just played it purely for laughs, which
well, he goes,
I appreciate
he goes
there's
all
also
the way
a really funny part. There's a really funny part earlier where they're watching on TV. It's like the Montel cameo where they're having like a public issue show about
same
it.
Shit.
Like, Montel is agreeing with the Italian guy, and then like the Italian guy's like, when my ancestors came over from Sicily in the Middle Passage, and then immediately, once again, you step onto someone else's territory, and Montel is just like, whoa, hold on a second, buddy.
That's
the Middle
our
Passage
thing.
Refers to like the you know, Africans who were brought to the New World.
Yeah.
Who braved the perilous Middle Passage.
Whoa, Middle Passage? That's the term for the slave trade.
Montel, the Italian people in this country also suffered discrimination.
Earth to fell. We're talking 300 years of slavery here.
Yeah, and
I like the Hesh thing, though, because he not only, like... He not only says that it's an unfair comparison, he immediately says, like, you're being anti-Semitic by even making the metaphor.
And the, covertly, I mean, as well. You're not even aware of you being anti-Semitic. It's just covert.
Yeah, he immediately just is like, oh, you're a racist piece of shit for making the comparison. And it's just like, and it's not a... Honestly, it's not an unfair portrayal of a lot of, like, I think older American Zionists in general, because Hesh is a Zionist in Sopranos canon. He's like, I think they said, you should don't ever talk to Hesh about giving back parts of Israel.
Which is also funny because another part of Hesh's character is that he's made a lot of his money by taking the publishing royalties from black musicians in the 60s.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's the perfect, like, distillation of kind of like, I would say, an older Jewish American myth about American Jews and our, you know, our love of the oppressed and, you know, our support of civil rights and whatnot. Because it's like, it's just this myth that we keep dragging into any conversation that always ends with, which is why I think that black people need to calm down, or which is why, you know, it's always ends with something racist.
It's American exceptionalism, but like right. Everybody's been in the story's been raised with this idea of American exceptionalism, and they apply that to their old baggage from the old world.
Yeah.
Where it's like they have these competing myths where it's like, we have been oppressed, but we are also exceptionally oppressed. Like, we are the only ones who've ever suffered oppression.
And it lays the groundwork for justification for fucked up shit. And that's kind of like what this episode does mostly, which is use the kind of like the myth that they've created there of their exceptional immigrant story as groundwork for why this other group of people is actually bad. And it's like why Indians are bad, why Cubans are bad. It's just like it's pretty great. But yeah, the... one thing that was mentioned in that clip was the fact that Tony says that his son has started talking badly about
Another classic, Columbus. Absolutely classic Sopranos moment.
Oh, just our favorite
anytime
boy.
Anytime AJ gets a little bit of knowledge.
Anytime.
It's a very dangerous thing. It's so funny. When he's reading from Howard's Inn and he says, with 50 men, we could subgate them.
Oh, yeah.
I have
They would make fine servants. With 50 men, we could subgate them.
Subjugate?
It's just one of those days!
His history teacher, Mr. Cushman, is teaching your son that if Columbus was alive today, he would go on trial for crimes against humanity like Milosevic and, you know, Europe.
So you finally read a book and it's bullshit.
Tony.
People thought the world was flat for crying out loud. Then he lands on an island with a bunch of naked savages on it. I mean, that took a lot of guts. You remember when we went to Florida, the heat, and those bugs?
Well, like it took us to murder people and put them in chains.
He was a victim of his time.
Who cares? It's what he did.
Break your fucking face tonight!
He discovered America is what he did. He was a brave Italian explorer. And in this house, Christopher Columbus is a hero. End of story.
Come and get it!
I love that because it just reminds me of those fucking signs that everybody has in LA where it's like, in this house, we believe in science. Like, I like that there's an Italian version of that where it's, in this house, Christopher Columbus is a hero. Yeah,
that's absolutely right. Oh, my God. Yeah. In this house, Christopher Columbus is a hero. Psychiatry is a racket for the Jews.
Yeah. I really like about that one is like in defending Christopher Columbus.
Yes.
One of Tony's justifications is like, remember how hot it was in Florida when we stayed there?
It's a very brave thing for him to do, to sail all the way across the sea to somewhere where it's hot. Like, that's
fucking humid as shit. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a moment in that same conversation where, you know, where Carmela points out to AJ, George Washington has slaves, and he goes, what's your point? Which is just like, is perfect. It's just a perfect moment, because like, there's AJ, I can't tell whether in that moment AJ is too smart or too stupid, like whether or not he can't make that connection to go like, oh, so I guess it's some of our heroes are flawed, or if he just looks at that and goes like, no, yeah, George Washington is trash too, then, I guess, which is fair enough. I just any scene with AJ just makes me so happy.
Yeah, I like that Michael Imperioli wrote this episode, and I enjoy that he always writes himself as like the dumbest person. Whenever, like, every Michael Imperioli written episode, Christopher ends up looking like the dumbest. And he really basically only gave himself dumb guy lines in this. Like, there's like when they talk about when Hesh brings up the smallpox blankets and Christopher is just like, no shit.
Yeah.
And then at the very end, where Tony's trying to make, and this is very interesting. At the very end of the episode, Tony's sort of like, you know, putting identity in like sort of group categorization of yourself, and just this kind of like, you know, petty bargaining over who's been victimized more hundreds of years ago, whose great grandparents have been victimized more by America, and he goes back to like his original thing about Gary Cooper. You know, whatever happened to Gary Cooper, you know, the strong, the silent type, you know, and he's like, and if you would have been around now, you would have been bitching about, you know, I'm from some poor Irish, you know, Texas background, the gay cowboys or whatever. And then Christopher goes, he was gay? Gary Cooper was gay? And he's like, no, you idiot. Like, I'm not, he's missing the point.
They discriminate against all Italians as a group when they disallow Columbus.
Oh, will you fucking stop? Group. Whatever the fuck happened to Gary Cooper? That's what I'd like to know.
He died.
I don't know. If he was a metagon around nowadays, he'd be a member of some victims group. The fundamentalist Christians, the abused cowboys, the gays, whatever the fuck.
He was gay, Gary Cooper?
No! Are you listening to me?
Yeah, it's he did also, though, write himself a little bit as the most open-minded to the idea that Columbus is bad, which is like almost like writing himself as woke, but I appreciate the fact that it's like, is it wokeness, or is he just so poorly educated that he didn't even know to be prideful about Christopher Columbus or something like that?
Well, he's also the youngest gangster, which I think is like the important, like, maybe
he's the new generation that's like, doesn't hold Christopher Columbus to this, God status.
It reminds me of like his sort of like his sort of ethical and political attitudes. It reminds me of like the scene where he tries to finagle a threesome with him, Adriana, and the FBI agent. Yeah. And then later when he's called on it, he's like, she's a fucking dyke. What do you want from me?
Yeah, yeah. She took my hand and put it on herself. She was rubbing it on herself. Like, that's fantastic. Another thing in this episode that I love is the, and this is a theme throughout all of The Sopranos, is just the way they write kind of, the way they make fun of academics and intellectuals. Mm-hmm. And the first instance of that is with the speaker at the event talking about anti-Italian American discrimination. And we discussed that a little bit, but I have a clip of that.
America still sees us as pizza makers and Mama Leone's. Well, it is your job, ladies, to spread the word. Our grandmothers may have been dressed in black, but we're in Moschino and Armani.
Start from the bottom.
For those who say Italian Americans eat smelly cheese and sip cold wine, tell them we're from the land of aromatic Asiago and supple Barolo.
So I got to point out that this is by far my least favorite part of the episode, but also like people say blah, blah, blah. Who the fuck says that?
That's what I'm saying.
Number one.
Yeah. Honestly, like there are stereotypes here that she's low key inventing. And I'm just like, wait, first of all, smelly cheese. I do not think Italian American smelly cheese at the same time. I'm not sure if that is even, is that a thing?
And by the way, like, she,
I thought that was a, if she said French, I'd be like,
she
okay.
She complains about Italians being associated with smelly cheese, and then she brags about, of all the cheeses, Asiago? Like, that's going to be the, of all the good cheeses in Italy, you're going to fucking brag about Asiago, like the fucking Edom of Italy? Like, what the fuck? As a cheese lover, I'm offended by that. But it's funny because the other, like the person who came up, who has story credit on this episode, is Maria Lorino, who is, she worked for the Village Voice and wrote some essays like in the Times. She wrote a couple memoirs, including Were You Always Italian? And a second memoir, Old World Daughter, New World Mother.
I'm sorry, but like there's this whole industry of like being wowed by Italian heritage.
She is
so weird.
She is that person speaking at the luncheon, and it's so weird to me because I can't imagine, like, of all the identities to struggle with, like the idea that people are struggling with their Italian identity is the most ridiculous fucking thing I've ever heard.
I mean, maybe it's generational. I don't know. I mean, I assume it is. Obviously, there were generations in which Italian Americans were systemically discriminated against, I'm sure, and weren't considered white and blah, 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 blah. But it's so many decades have passed. And also, that's been the case with so many other ethnic groups for which there are and still are actual consequences for that. I'm just like, who can say with a straight face, oh, boy, you know, Italian-American discrimination in this country?
Right.
Like, to,
and by the way,
it's
like,
so strange.
Have you ever met any Italian under age 80 who feels who legitimately has chafed under the idea that people associate them with the mafia? Like, I've never
met an Italian who wasn't proud of the association.
Yeah, yeah. And there's another funny part at the end of the luncheon scene that's like, you know, I think, like, you know, the writers of the show were of course, you know, aware, because, like, you know, when The Sopranos came out, there was, they dealt with their own version of this, of, like, you know, people being like, oh, this is a stereotypical portrayal of Italians as being part of organized crime. And it was like, Father Intintola is just like, you know, okay, well, let me take the devil's advocate to you. I read a recent study that says that the vast majority of people understand that these are fictional portrayals and, like, have no bearing on, and then, like, it's the perfect, like, parody of the fucking, like, just academic, like, jive talk that this woman, like, the people like that come from. She's just like, well, we're looking at the sample sizes.
Right, exactly. Closely, yeah.
We'll get back to you on it.
Yeah, we're doing an investigation into that study that kind of destroys my entire career angle. So
right.
Let's not bring that up.
Like, that scene is a perfect mirror of the Hesh scene, because just as Hesh, like, immediately accused the Cuban guy of being anti-Semitic for even entertaining the analogy, like, the mob wives immediately go after Father Phil just for, like, having that woman as a speaker, who, just for the sin of even bringing up the mob.
Bringing up John Gotti.
It's not like she was, like, on stage railing against, like, them. Like, she's like, I know there are people out there in this audience now. Right. We're part of this problem and looking the other way. Yeah, no, it's just like the mere even suggestion of it. They're like, you know, well, we've been the ones who are really supporting this parish, you know, so you need to think long and hard about who your friends really are. Yeah.
And
the indignity that they feel about it is so funny.
Yeah, especially like in the like confrontation with Father Phil, Gabby says Carmela has borne the brunt of these accusations because of her husband, who is high up in the garbage industry. And it's like, you're literally lying to yourself and to him at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
she's borne the brunt of these accusations solely for making the choice to marry a mob boss and profiting off his criminal enterprise for the last 30 years.
Yeah. It's so weird to find it offensive that someone is like, hey, Italians, you know, we're more than just the mafia, you know, and not all of us are in that. And to be in the mafia and be like, fuck you, that's not true, we're all in the mafia. Like, like, I'm not even sure.
No, they were mad for her for even bringing it up, for even like saying the name of the mafia. I think.
John Gotti, yeah. It's beautiful, because imagine, it's like you say, you have to, you live the myth so long that you're just like, you're piling your feelings on top of it, so that she's like mad that like someone would bring up the existence of the mafia that her husband is currently in. It's pretty great.
So I gave my shout out to my least favorite moment. Can we do favorite, least favorite?
Sure. Let me see if I have a, I don't know if I have a least favorite. I think, and this is unfair because I do think this is a funny scene, but it's kind of an outlier. The scene where Ralphie, goes up to, the Native American guy who was,
Del Red Clay. Yeah.
Del Red Clay.
Like, absolutely like sleazy Ralphie bit where he's like, I represent a group of Italians, family people.
Yeah. Family people.
He's like, we're taking exception with this, initiative you're spearheading, no pun intended.
Right.
And then he does all this totally like gross Ralphie shit to the young grad student.
Right. She goes, hi. Yeah. I'm Del's TA, and he looks at her and goes, yeah, I can see that, which is a pretty good tits and ass joke. Yeah. I got to admit.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he's pretty, I mean, you know, that's not bad.
And it's very Michael Imperioli writing, is to acknowledge all of the puns and every bit of dialogue.
All of the puns, yeah. Imagine, like, the cutting room floor on the puns on most of his scripts. Holy shit. But that scene in general, kind of like the whole, like, what we're going to expose Ironized Cody. Like, I'm not really sure.
It was not as funny or as smart as, like, I mean, and I guess like it does work because the whole point of it is that it doesn't matter and no one gives a shit.
Right.
Well,
yeah.
Like, to that end,
I really like that conceptually, because like when Tony is yelling at Silvio for why does he care about this and you know, like, what, why are you being so stupid by going to beat up like protesters? And Sil goes, oh, well, you know, me and Ralphie got something in the works. Don't worry about it. And then the thing that's in the works is like their shitty conspiracy about the Ironized Cody being Italian, which I guess was apparently true. But yeah.
Right. To me, I was like, it's funny, but like, I think I could only take so many silly mafia scenes before I was just like, all right, like this, especially the fact that the plan kind of went nowhere. And I don't know. I mean, I know that was the point, but I in lieu of like having no least favorite scene, because I fucking love this episode, right, I would say that one.
All right.
Favorite scene, I would have to say, oh God, man, it's hard, but I think it's a combination of Janice's last therapy scene leading into her breakup, because the last therapy scene that happens is Janice tells, you know, the therapist that, yeah, I'm interested in this guy, Bobby. Yeah, he works for my brother, but it's not like that. And she goes, okay, well, back to Ralphie, you know, what you need to do is to, you know, come at him honestly with the care and compassion that you're famous for. And then, like, to me, the next scene between them is Janice trying to figure out how to break up with Ralphie and deciding the best thing to do is to yell at him about nothing and push him down the stairs. I have a clip of Janice and Ralphie breaking up.
Janutsky! This is it, hon. This is the last of the stuff I had at Rose.
Your shoes.
What?
Didn't I ask you to take your shoes off when you came in this house?
I forgot.
So that's just it. You fucking forgot! Get out! Get out!
My back. My back. I'll kill you, crazy bitch. I'll kill you, bitch. You crazy cunt!
Get out!
Talk about having no plan at all and just winging it. You know, like
I always think about like the lost art of ADR whenever we play Sopranos clips because like they're just the audio alone is so funny and there's and like the way they build sound effects and nobody really does that anymore. Like they always it seems like everybody tries to record everything on set so you get these like muffled kind of shitty sound mixes and no one does those like layer cake audio editing like they do here.
Yeah. RIP Foley artists. Yeah. I'm sure there's still some around. I would say that was my favorite. Will, do you have a favorite scene or a least favorite?
Yeah, so the least favorite is the one we talked about. I think the whole Ironized Cody plot line doesn't quite land her, but I think it does actually like pay off pretty fun. I mean, it pays off because I think the whole joke of it is that like no one gives a shit or remembers or cares in the first place.
And comparing it to James Caan not being Italian, I thought
was
pretty funny.
And also, I love the James Caan moment because in that scene, I swear to God, like you can kind of see in Sills behind his eyes that he didn't know James Caan.
Yes,
was Jewish.
Exactly. I completely agree.
He is actually like quite crestfallen. And
he has
Corleone
to pretend like
isn't actually Sicilian.
He has to pretend that it's not a big deal to him in the moment.
It's not crushing him to find that out.
You can tell he's suppressing it so hard.
Yeah. I think my favorite scene is, you know, I think the one we already talked about, the we're so wacky sex scene between Ralphie and Janice. And just the line, we're so wacky. Like that to me is the best moment of the show. But there is a very minor personal connection to this episode because the actor who plays the CEO of the Mohonk Reservation Casino was the brother of my high school advisor.
Really?
And I just remember like being really like impressed that her brother was the guy who tries to take Nicolas Cage's rabbit in Con Air. But I also love that character too because it's like just another very like very venomous assault on these kind of like you know identity group like fucking grifters where they're just like he's like you know you don't really look Native American. He's like, well, yes, actually, I've passed as white for most of my life, but I had a racial awakening when it turned out that I had like I could access like hundreds of millions of dollars through this casino. He's like, yeah, the Elizabeth Warren character in this episode,
right?
Yes,
straight
guy.
Up,
he's like, yeah.
Yeah,
and he's like, I had a racial awakening, is what he said when I discovered my Mohonk blood.
He probably
by that he means like a great grandmother was like half Mohonk,
which
probably,
is so crazy.
He probably contributed an episode, a recipe to powwow chow chow.
Yeah.
Oh man, yeah, that's pretty great. I even thought like. As on the nose as Chief Doug Smith is, it still was like, it was still very funny. And there's also this moment, again, Michael Imperioli writing, where he said, it's okay, I had some business in Manhattan. And Artie goes, uh-oh, not again. Just like, just a fucking great joke. That's pretty wonderful. And all in all, you know, I would say this episode, I don't know. Solid B+.
The solidest B+, I think.
Mm-hmm. Will, if you had to rate the episode between, let's say, B+ and B+, what would you rate this episode?
God, I mean, shit. I got to go B+.
Yeah, I think so.
I think
solid
we're,
B+.
We're unanimous.
This is a solid B+ episode. Very, very good. All right. Well, that is the episode. Will, thanks so much for coming on Pod Yourself a Gun and podding with us.
My pleasure. It is a joy always to talk about the Sopranos, a show that, you know, honestly, like I was just thinking about last week as something that like is one of the rare examples of something that like I not just like as much as I did when I first saw it on TV, but in fact adore it even more with every time I return to it. I mean, it is one of the real great American television shows, and I don't think it has been, you know, the topped before or since then in its sort of novelistic approach to the American life. I mean, it's immensely rewarding, and I think doesn't get enough credit for being one of the funniest shows of all time too.
Yeah, completely agree. It is like whenever someone mentions it as a like just a great prestige TV show drama, I'm always just like, you know, you're missing. I can never tell whether or not people are missing it.
They call it that because I feel like people can't bear to think of a comedy as something that's like good and worthy of like artistic merit in quite the same way. So it's like they take a really funny show and they call it a drama just because mm-hmm. it's very good.
I mean, to be fair, it makes it funnier, the fact sure. that people think it's a drama. But yeah. like, this is a perfect example of an episode that I think is like, it's like, this is a perfect dumb guy episode. It's for like the dumb guy viewers. And I'm a dumb guy and I love it. You know, like, like some people need like a bunch of like serious drama. They need like, you know, five episodes where Melfi gets sexually assaulted and deals with it. But I'm like, I'll deal with some fucking racist jokes and a pun.
I like this one because it turns all of the therapy scenes into a joke, which I think yes. the therapy scenes are best when they're not, you know, taken as like a serious look into the character's psyche.
Yeah, completely. Completely. Will, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter at Will Menaker, and you can check out the podcast, Chapo Trap House, wherever fine podcasts are sold.
All right. Check out Chapo Trap House on the podcast stores that exist everywhere. All right. Frogcast@gmail.com for all your questions, comments, and concerns. Patreon.com/Frogcast for all of our bonus episodes where we talk about, you know, fucking everything, not just Sopranos. We talk about movies and other television shows. And now, real quick, Vince, are you ready?
Uh-oh.
For our $8 patrons, you got to give Mafia name.
Yeah.
All right. This is the Pod Yourself a Shout Out section of the end of the podcast. All right, our new $8 donors are Doug Forrester.
Oh, Doug. Yo, Dougie the Toucan.
All right, that's I don't see how that works, but that's good. That's
fine.
No,
that's good.
All right, and then we have Ryan.
Oh yeah, Ryan the Beak.
I think it feels like you're phoning this in.
What are you talking about? Those are all
all right, fine, that
perfectly
works.
Perfectly cromulent nicknames.
Perfectly cromulent. And finally, Tom.
Oh, Tom, that's Asian Tom.
I hope to God he's Asian so it works.
No, it's an inside joke. It's an inside joke from way back.
Yeah, you and Tom go way, way back. Yeah. All right, so once again, Patreon.com/Frogcast for all the bonus episodes. $8 tier gets yourself a shout out where Vince does his best to give you a mafia nickname. Vince, what's the Google voice number?
415-275-0030.
All right, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. And until next time, don't stop believing.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.